What's happening, weirdos? This is a big one. This is John C. Reilly, who I've been a fan of for decades. What is it? Magnolia, Step Brothers, a movie I watch every year, Boogie Nights, The Sisters Brothers. He's in everything. He's incredible. He's amazing. Gangs of New York. I can't believe he's here. And he pays out. He gives us so many wonderful stories. Changed my view of acting forever. Honestly, our conversation about acting just shifted how I even think about acting, which was awesome. So I'm so glad you guys are here. You can go see John C. Reilly. He is on tour with a show called Mr. Romantic, where he plays a character on a mission to fall in love with someone, anyone, at every single show. He's backed by Grammy-winning musicians and a Cracker Jack band. He's amazing. It's so fun. Go see Mr. Romantic. MrRomantic.com. Spell it out. MisterRomantic.com. Definitely give it a go. Definitely check it out. Everything he does is amazing. I'm so glad you're here. If you want to see me, go to PeteHolmes.com. I'm doing the Dania Improv in Florida coming up very soon. I'm also doing my show here in Los Angeles on May the 4th on Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. Tickets to that at PeteHolmes.com as well. Got my Largo show. Beck was at the last one. They're always so awesome. Go to Largo-LA.com. I do that monthly. It's called Pete Holmes Living at Largo. So whenever you hear this, I will be at Largo this month, which is one of the great joys of my life. So hope you can be there. And also at PeteHolmes.com, we are selling the last remaining vinyls of Dirty Clean, and 100% of the proceeds are going to Homeboy Industries, a charity very near and dear to my heart. So that is an album and a special that has the bit like, that doesn't make any fucking sense. You can get the vinyl of that while they last. Last vinyl maybe I'll ever make. So go get that vinyl. Go do it. PeteHolmes.com. In the meantime, so glad you're here. Enjoy the wonderful, the incredible, hilarious, the thoughtful, the thought-provoking John C. Reilly. Get into it.
Here, hold this like a stand-up comedian.
The one thing I haven't done.
Yeah, that's true.
The last frontier. I will one day.
Will you?
I think so.
Here, what?
I mean, I kind of do it.
No, you do it with you.
I don't like to reveal much of my actual thoughts, my actual personality, so I'm a little careful about that, but.
Yeah.
I think I could tell some fun stories.
If it's okay, we're just going to roll. Is that,
yes.
Is that okay?
Sorry, I didn't get your name.
It's Katie.
Katie.
Such a genteel man.
Well,
you are. I'm always.
People matter, Pete. People matter.
No, can I say one more? It's all we got.
Yeah.
That's it.
That is what I say during Mr. Romantic. This is all we have. The machines won't save us.
That's right. This is all we have. But like even this, like that's why I'm glad to have this show as an excuse to dial in and just make it small, just for the next whatever. It's just us. It's all we got. There's a lot going on. But
that's
just for,
enough.
It is
it's gonna
enough.
Have to be enough.
It's gonna have to be enough.
I'm just looking at your Steve Martin cover there. That was like, I think that one of the first records I actually bought.
Yeah.
As a kid.
Was Let's
Get Stole some before that, but I kind of think I stole a Rolling Stone album before that. But
oh,
I bought that one and I have some amazing memories of listening to that record. I was obsessed with it. Like
everybody,
like a lot of people my age at that time. But I remember sitting with my mom and on the bedroom floor, she heard me listening to it and she's like, "What is going on in here? What are you laughing so hard at?" And I was like, "Oh, mom, you got to hear it. You got to hear it." And she was of another generation. Her and my father are both like almost like a World War II generation, even though they weren't of that generation. They kind of thought like that.
They co-opted it.
I was wondering how she was going to respond to it. And we sat and listened to it and she loved it. She was just cracking up and like... It was fantastic. It was like that scene in Alice B. Toklas when the in-laws accidentally eat pot brownies and they're
yes.
just cackling with laughter.
Yes, because if that had gone the other way, I remember listening to comedy with my mom. I remember Ace Ventura. There's that sex scene. Do you remember? Have you seen Ace Ventura recently?
Yeah, not recently, but yeah.
You know, it actually holds up.
Yeah?
I don't mean to say actually. There's some stuff that doesn't hold up. Don't get me wrong. There's a whole, it didn't age well kind of sequence. But there's, you know, a lot of it does, and there's a part where they're just going at it like a hardcore, it's like comedically big sex scene.
Mm.
And I remember my mom like covering my eyes and stuff. It can be so
I did
weird.
One of those, I did a comedically over-the-top sex scene with Jenna Fischer in Walk Hard.
Yes.
And even though we're trying to be comedic and over the top, it was like, you know, the whole movie is a satire on one thing or another, but the satire in that scene was animalistic sex scenes between like long lost lovers or whatever. So we're doing all this stuff. We're like almost kissing and then not kissing, almost kissing and not kissing, and like breathing really close to each other. And it was like, this is turning into a real sex scene. Like, this like is kind of like, hot. Even though we're trying to be funny, it's kind of hot. Like throwing each other around the room and stuff.
Anyway, yeah. Do you
it
ever?
It was charged.
Sometimes, as a silly boy, when I'm actually having sex, it's tempting to be silly. Because you know what it is? Every night I get in bed with my wife just to sleep, and I'm tempted, we'll cuddle a little bit. I'm always tempted to be like, like just like because it's so vulnerable and so quiet. Like
you can't resist.
And in the same way, sometimes when you're having sex, it's really hard. Not always, but sometimes I'm tempted to like reference something or something that had happened that day.
I wish I was one of those people that could be kind of funny about sex, but I don't think I am.
Like more of a silly bean in that way?
I think I'm more like it's a sacred bond moment. It's almost like a spiritual connection to me.
That's why
I was never like very good at like sleeping around. I've been married for 31 years now, but when I was younger, like I'd always had to be friends with the person and know them as a friend, blah, blah, and then it would move into sex or romance or whatever.
Yeah. And none of that, it wasn't like religious or anything. It was just kind of like.
I mean, I grew up Catholic, but not really. No, that's not what I was thinking about. Yeah. It was just more like, how could this be casual? Like, this is not casual. Like,
Yeah.
I'm revealing my soul to this person.
Like, and even biochemically, you know, neurologically, there's so much going on during sex that is intensely bonding. As an actor, have you ever done like gazing exercises?
Oh, yeah.
Stuff like that. Well, you see how quickly.
And in clown workshops, too.
You clown?
Yeah.
You clown,
I was
bro?
A clown when I was a kid, and I've been getting back into it lately because this show I do, Mr. Romantic.
Edit that out.
The ostensible reason I'm here.
Edit that out.
is kind of a clown show. I don't wear like clown makeup per se. A little rouge, but
not full clown face.
But it's a vaudeville act. You know, it's kind of like an emotional magic act, all about love. And have you seen it?
I know. Come on. Just walk out.
It's not like.
Do you want me to listen?
I get it. You don't get to Largo very much. You're not over there. I understand.
You're the first. I've been out of town 7-day spiritual retreat.
Wow.
Which is on like a non-dual retreat. You're the first episode. And this is how much I was excited to have you come on. Because, of course, you take a day to integrate, right? You can't just come back from like all that meditating and stuff. But this was the only day you could do. So here we are. And that is my commitment and love and excitement for you. But had I not,
I could do
been
it
away,
any day this week.
Honestly, I know.
I don't know who told
son
you that.
Son of a bitch. Well, they didn't.
I think
tell
they're all just trying
video
to slot him into one day or something. I did a few other interviews earlier today. But
oh, you been chatting away?
A little bit, not too much.
Not too. You're not burnt
and
out.
And I'm not really. I mean, talking about Mr. Romantic, the show.
Edit that out.
Is really like a labor of love. It's like my own thing. It's this thing that just came out of me. So it's different than doing like press for a film that someone else directed or
that
whatever.
That would be so beautiful if we left that in the show. But
I'm curious about your spiritual retreat because I meditate every day. I do transcendental meditation.
Yeah.
What was silence or?
It wasn't a silent retreat. In fact, I went in, I was just telling my wife this, I went in chewing nicotine gum. I got like nicotine. And day one, I was just like, I'm not feeling like I need it. And it's so interesting. And my wife joked, it was like, yeah, because you were in rehab. Like, she was like, that's why rehab works. Like, all your meals are communal.
Right.
So, like, so much
of your wife
addiction,
is not there stressing you out. Like,
take that, sweetheart. But, like, so much of it was sharing, not being silent, was having time with like-minded people that are interested in, you know, having a firmly established center, for lack of a better way to put it.
Sounds like a cult.
There were some cult stuff.
But I've been studying cults lately.
I love cults. Which one's yours? Like, what's your
favorite?
Well,
you could, I mean, I would imagine some people think transcendental meditation is a cult, but it doesn't have some of the hallmarks of a cult.
Okay, well, remember the ceremony? About. You've been doing it a long time, but there's that ceremony with the rice and the incense and there's the photograph.
Yeah, but that's, the thing about it is, there is no dogma about transcendental meditation. There is nothing you actually have to believe.
Yeah.
There's no God. There's no, none of that stuff. All you have to do is just do this on a regular basis and it works, whether you believe it or not.
Yeah.
Which I was like, oh, great. No dogma, no guru. There is a guru because the Maharishi like sort of put it together for modern audiences or whatever. But
and the Beatles.
Yeah. But for thousands of years before that, you know, it's not like it's really his. He just
how did you get turned on to that? I did it too, by the way.
I needed it.
Yeah,
I needed it. I was just having trouble. My mind was just too much traffic in my mind, you know, and I'm not really an anxious person, but I was having a lot of mental pollution, just agitation, and I don't know exactly why it came to me. I remember I asked a friend, I was like, because I assumed he was all into this new age stuff. It was Mike White, actually. I asked Mike, I was like, Mike, you do TM, right? Can you tell me about that? And he's like, actually, no, I don't do that. I was like, whoa, why did I think you did it? And then he told me about someone else who did, and they hooked me up with this teacher, and I learned it, but that's really the last interaction I had with the organization of Transcendental Meditation. Yeah, it was just meeting.
Was it here in L.A.?
Penny, yeah.
Who taught? Do you remember
her name? Is Penny Hintz. She taught David Lynch to do it years ago.
Did he take to it?
Oh yeah, he's a super devout.
100% J.K.
Oh, sorry. That's the thing about me. I don't traffic so much in sarcasm. Yeah,
it wasn't sarcasm, but I did
a
full mug to the camera. That was to include you, to let you know that I was joking, but you were off. It's okay.
Yeah. So,
but do you find it? Not this is a leading question. Do you find it as just a stress life improvement?
Just found that in your couch, by the way.
Could have been Marianne Williamson's. We like to blame her if people find stuff in the couch. Did you do it for higher purpose reasons or just kind of, no wrong answer, kind of like regulate stress, quiet your mind sort of thing? Or was it to figure it all out?
Yeah, I just needed it. I was like, I need more peace. Like the things I was doing to get peace for myself were not really delivering after a while. And
Well, that's
I did it really I was devoutly for a long time. And then I had this sort of mini crisis in my head where I was like, why are you doing this? This is stupid. You're just sitting here saying a mantra to yourself. You could just do this by, you know, just being more mindful or whatever. And I kind of got off it for a while. And then I needed it again. Then I was like, no, this is not. I'm not a very habitual person. I'm not a very disciplined person. I'm not someone that does anything on a regular basis. But doing TM on a regular basis really has, it's given me a lot.
Yeah.
It's really given me a lot of peace.
Different? No routines whatsoever?
I'll have like patches of routine and then it just goes to the wayside. But miraculously, meditating has been something I do every day.
Been able to
take it with it's the first thing in my life other than like taking care of my kids or whatever, when I wake up and like, oh no, I need to do that for sure. Mm. And if I forget, I'll go, oh no, oh my gosh, I forgot. Every once in a while, I'll forget. But
yeah. Have you ever been doing it and someone thinks something's wrong with you? That happened to me a lot. I was on a film set, actually, and I was like looking, I was really into it at that time. So I was like, I'm not going to miss. And I went, it was lunch, and I went and found a little corner and I sat down, closed my eyes. Like four people checked on me. They were just like, are you okay? They thought I was having like, I don't know.
Yeah,
like a psychic break.
I usually tell people I'm 20 minutes. And
yeah.
But
it's never been mistaken for psychosis.
Given me a lot. No, and Penny actually told me, she's like, people will, if you're in your car by yourself doing it,
put your
sunglasses on.
Yeah, that's a good tip.
Because then it just looks like you're just sitting there, or whatever.
That's a good tip. I wonder if this your schedulelessness helps you flow and merge into a film set, because that is really giving your life to another schedule. Every day is different, and you really have to be in service.
I do like to be completely, my favorite day ever since I was a little kid, as long as I can remember, my favorite days are like waking up, what should I do now? Eat when I'm hungry, go outside when I feel like walking around, you know, like just letting days unfold. That's really like my personality. I actually don't like to figure out things ahead of time or analyze things too much, or that's just kind of like how I am.
And that
you reminded me of something, though. This is kind of coarse, but when I shoot a movie, sometimes I'm convinced that there's like a shit detector in the trailer.
What do you mean? I asked her to turn the air on.
Oh. It was a good story for that. because whenever I have to go to the bathroom number two, I'll like check things out. All right, I definitely have time. There's nothing around. I'm not going to be needed, et cetera, et cetera. I go into the trailer. You sit down on the toilet and then bump, bump, bump. Like, almost without fail, an AD comes
when you're pooping.
Yeah, and you're like, and then you have that awful thing where you're in the bathroom. I'm in the. You have to yell really loud to be heard. Like,
I've noticed that phenomenon, by the way. If you're sitting on the couch in a trailer and someone knocks on the door, I'll yell, "Come in." They've never come in. Have you noticed this? I don't know how thick these doors are. You go, "Come in," and they just
well, in order comes. To be heard over the air conditioning or something, it sounds like you're already mad, like you're yelling. Like,
yes.
One day I just did this TV show where I had Winning Time, where I play the Dr. Jerry Buss, and he, super stressful life, as it turns out.
Yeah.
You know, especially the first year he had that team. So a lot of my scenes were like raising my voice or being passionate about something or whatever. And I would run my lines in the trailer with someone before I had to go. And one day I was like, "What is going on? What? I thought they said they were ready. What is going on? Like, can you find out what's going on?" And then finally, like, the AD wasn't even near the trailer. And finally, like, this person who I asked to help tracked down the AD. And she's like, "I didn't want to knock. It just sounded like it was a bad moment." And I was like, "What?" She's like, "You were really screaming at somebody." I was like, "I was doing my lines. I wasn't screaming at it. What? You think I would yell like that at somebody? Like, I don't know. I don't know."
Can I tell you my favorite Jerry Buss moment in season one, just if it meant anything to you? I thought it was so funny and so novel. Was you're eating lobster by the pool, and then you go, "I got to wash this butter off," and then you jump in the pool. And I was like,
that was improvised.
It was?
Yeah. I improvise a lot when I work.
Well, then I'm glad your hat's off, because hat's off. That's incredible. It felt like the perfect summation of that character is.
And I did have a lot of butter all over my hands and my face and my belly. Like, definitely needed to get rid of the butter.
But doesn't that seem like a character trait, like, of Jerry Buss? It would be like a guy who eating lobster by a pool would just jump in the pool to wash it off. Like, that felt perfect.
I loved that. Anyway, I haven't seen the show, but weirdly, I haven't watched it, but I do remember shooting that scene and jumping into the pool, and there's like this fantasy moment with all the girls around me in the pool, and I'm supposed to be going, "I'm fucked," or whatever. I say something like, "Oh my God, I'm fucked." Like, I scream underwater because I just find out that I'm, this paperwork was bad news. But there's all these girls around me in the pool, a whole circle of them and their legs. And they were like, "You guys should be laughing and having fun. Like, all of you should be laughing." And underwater, I could hear this ghostly, like, like mermaids underwater. It was incredible. And I was like, I came up and I was like, "You guys, we got to get a microphone in the water somehow. You won't believe what it sounds like under there." Like, all these legs going like this, then like
water ghostly. Ruins laughter, it turns out. Have you ever seen a ghost? You seem like a guy that's seen a ghost.
I thought I saw a few ghosts, but I think it was sleep apnea.
What did it look like? Difficulty breathing?
What? No, it was always like I'd wake up with a start, like a noise. I thought I'd heard a noise, and then I'd see something like going out of the room. Or I would have these like hallucinations or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I realized I had sleep apnea and needed
a
CPAP machine. That was literally my body saying, "You're dying, wake up."
Right. And your brain misfires. UFO?
UFO, I don't think so.
What about something you can't explain? You ever go to a psychic and they knew something really impossible?
Well, yeah. I mean, no, I've never been to a psychic, but...
Something unexplainable?
Well, when my father was sick, he had a brain tumor and eventually died from it. But it was, I was off doing a movie and checking in with my sisters and my family about what was going on with him, and it wasn't looking good, but he wasn't, they weren't like, you should think about coming home to Chicago. It was just sort of like, things are not great. And I was sleeping, and in the dream I saw, so I won't explain the long dream, but basically I was in like a rooming house trying to fall asleep in this big room full of beds, like an old wood-floored rooming house with beds all over the place. And I came in at night with my wife in the dream, and everyone was already asleep in the beds, and we're like, oh, thank God, there's at least there's a bed somewhere we can stay. Like, we get under the covers, and we just have to relax and close, you know, fall asleep. And then with my eyes closed, all of a sudden there's like rustling, people getting up from beds. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it. With my eyes closed in the dream, I can't believe people are now getting up. We just got here, we're trying to fall asleep. I can't believe it. And I, all of a sudden I sense people right near our bed. And I opened my eyes, and my father was in line, slowly moving in this line out of the room. And I remember staring at his face, and he was talking to the person in front of him like, can you believe we're in this fucking line? I couldn't hear, really hear what he was saying. But in the dream, I was staring at his face, somehow knowing this is the last time I'm going to see his face.
Whoa.
I knew in the dream, and I'm staring, and I'm like, I have to memorize the details of his face because this is the last time I'm going to see him. And literally, the phone rang and woke me up from this dream, and my sister said, Dad just passed.
Whoa.
Well, I can't explain that. I had no, there was no, I'm telling you, I know what was going on at the time, and it wasn't like any kind of emergency thinking or anything.
Yeah.
It was like sad that he had this tumor or whatever, and there was an operation, et cetera, but...
Whoa.
But then two other people in my family that night, the same thing. And one of my sisters had a dream where he was packing up his boat to leave. She was laying down in this house and could see him out by this dock packing up his boat to leave.
Wow.
And then he did. And another, an aunt of mine that same night. So I can't explain that. I mean, how could you explain that?
Yeah, that's incredible. Thank you for telling me that. That's awesome. I mean, not awesome what happened, but that
experience. Yeah, it was awesome. My dad
was literally awesome.
But I think there's a lot we don't understand. If you think about, like, just for an analogy, how much of the ocean is unexplored, or how much about space we don't understand.
Or the human mind, yeah.
Or the brain, how much we don't understand, even about how our own bodies actually work. And it wasn't that long ago before it was like leeches and stuff were the answer, you know, like
they say that we're going to look at this time as a leech time with the advent of AI by 2030 or something, 2035, I think.
Well, I hope we get some stuff figured out with the help of AI. That would be good.
I think so.
I do think there's metaphysical things. There are metaphysical things that exist that we don't understand yet. The way matter behaves and plasma and all this.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that we just conceptually don't understand yet. So how could you assume that we've got it all locked down and there's no such thing as ghosts?
Or dreams or visions, really, is what kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah, or a metaphysical aspect of human life, you know? Yeah.
Have you had any contact kind of with your dad emotionally or supernaturally? Is there a connection there?
Well, there's been a lot of times when I was, like, hoping for a miracle, and I literally, Dad, if you can put it in a word, like, I mean, the day of my dad's death is the anniversary of the Irish Peace Accords in Ireland, and I was like, maybe he had something to do with that because he was a super ardent Irishman, Irish American. Anyway, I think there's a lot that we don't understand.
Oh, of course. I think there a famous psychologist said we don't understand 99% of how the mind works or how the brain works, not even just the concept mind, but the brain. They're like,
much to be, I don't know. I don't go around thinking a lot about how I don't understand most, you know, you just have to go with what you have. Like in the 1800s, leeches is what they had, you know, like, the best we got.
Now we got Tylenol.
Yeah.
I guess Tylenol is where it's at. It's going to be crazy to see where it goes. It really is. Going back to what you were saying about doing your lines in the trailer and yelling, I was really excited because I'm such a fan of your acting, all the different styles. I know it's all acting, but I think you're hilarious, and I'm a big fan of your dramatic work as well. Here's my question. How much of acting is getting over that acting is sort of embarrassing? Like, how much of that is would you consider your job? And to preface it a little bit, you know, everyone knows you're pretending. They're filming you. Now you're very calm, and 3, 2, 1, you have to be yelling. So there's something kind of like...
To you.
Not just me. It's a Ted Danson quote, as he did a scene.
Well, you and Ted Danson. But I'm saying, like...
You don't find it embarrassing?
It's like, how much of acting has to do with, like, drinking a gallon of water beforehand? Like, well, I don't. I'm not embarrassed by it. Like,
yeah.
You know what, actually, what is kind of embarrassing...
That's a fascinating answer. You're not embarrassed.
No, ever since I was a little kid, when I started doing plays, it just seemed to be a natural thing to me. Like, this idea of pretending and this idea of crossing over into an imaginary place, it was just like, yeah, this is where I am most of the time.
Mm.
This is just like, when I first did my first acting class, when I was a little kid at the park near my house... I remember thinking, like, at first, oh, this is kind of weird. Like, the teacher was having us be pieces of bacon in a pan. And I'm going to turn up the heat now. What happens? It's like an exercise to get you kind of in touch with your body and your imagination firing. But I remember thinking, like, at first, like, oh, this is kind of weird. A piece of bacon. No one's ever asked me to do this before. Like, when I was 8. And then as it started to happen, I looked around the room and everyone was doing this bacon stuff. I was like, I have found my people. I knew at that young age, I was like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. These are the people that understand me. This is what I'm like.
Yeah. Like, and what do you mean place... you spent most of your time there? Like, you were like a big fantasy kid? Like, just kind of
yeah,
in
just you know, like, I think most kids, especially younger than, say, 6 years old, they're still a little bit in the world of the pixies. You know, they don't see, like... I realized this from doing animation. Like, I did these two movies, Wreck-It Ralph movies.
My daughter loves, she's 5 and a half. She loves Wreck-It Ralph.
Well, if I were to meet your daughter, if she's 5 and a half, I bet if you said, honey, this is Wreck-It Ralph, she would look at me and go, no, it isn't. Because he doesn't look anything like Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah.
Like, younger than 6 years old, you realize they think cartoons are real.
Oh, I've shown her cartoons that I'm in, and I don't think she knows what's going on.
Yeah, so they don't quite
go,
put
that's
it together.
Daddy. And she's like,
That's what I mean. I'm like, I was always in that place of imagination. Like, being involved in fantasy was something that just came really naturally to me. I just always... That said, I didn't... It's not like when I was a little kid, I wasn't one of those kids like, I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to be the world's greatest actor. Like, I'm made for the stage or movies or whatever. Like, I had no reference points for that, for it being a life or a job or anything like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I was almost done with college where I went to a conservatory of acting school that I was like, oh, maybe this could be my job.
Mm.
Like, I literally didn't consider it because I come from a very working class, you know, blue collar kind of life in Chicago where I grew up. And I didn't have any examples. I didn't know anyone who was in any kind of show business, music or anything else. Like, so I remember just watching like Gene Hackman in The French Connection or Gene Wilder and you know, Willy Wonka, and just thinking like, that's what they're like. That's who they are. I didn't understand it as a
craft.
Yeah, as a craft.
Yeah.
A friend of mine got cast in a Francis Ford Coppola movie, Kevin J. O'Connor, who was from my same neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. And I was like, and he went to the same acting school as me. So as soon as he graduated from the acting school, he got that part. And I was like, oh man, it's possible. Hmm. It is possible to come from the south side and someone would ask you to be in a movie. It's possible.
Yeah.
I have to consider this now.
Like, that's how I felt about Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, because when I was in high school, just leaving high school, Good Will Hunting came out. And I would see them like at Harvard Square. I had friends that went to high school with them. And I was like, what? Like, it really, I wasn't in the land of the pixies, but I would go see a movie and I was like, these are the gods of our time. You know, like, I was really reverent, like literally biolocating. They're on all these different screens at the same time.
Yeah.
They're huge. they're making my father cry. You know what I mean? It's just like, and you this need, is huge.
Somehow you need this this concrete example that it is possible. You know, of course, I've been acting for 12, 15 years at that point. But to see someone do it, it actually happened. I needed that concrete reference point.
Would you talk a little bit, because when you were saying that, like Chicago, working class, and when you think of an actor, like someone who is going to be like, I'm going to be the best actor in the world, you think of someone who maybe looks like Tom Cruise. You know what I mean? That type.
I don't know. I don't know what Tom's journey was. Maybe not. You know, there's a lot of people that look like Tom Cruise that don't feel that way.
I'm saying, like, today, if there was an influencer that was like, I'm going to make it big. Well, maybe I'll finish the question. If somebody's really classically, you know, down the line, good looking guy, white teeth, winning, hey, personality. Right. Like, oh, there's an actor. And what's interesting is, here's you, interesting person. Gene Hackman, interesting person. Gene Wilder, interesting person. These aren't just models that talk. You know what I mean? They're complex. And then this working class Chicago thing makes you a rare and special commodity in LA, where every headshot is like a V-neck, white t-shirt, tan. You know what I'm saying? You are a handsome man. I'm just saying, like, isn't it funny that the things
I was at a party one time with Dustin Hoffman, and I think Joaquin Phoenix was there. I think it was the first night I met Joaquin. And Dustin Hoffman literally said, you know, you guys have a career because of me.
That's so funny.
Before me, people that looked like regular people did not get the leading role in movies. When I got The Graduate and Mike Nichols forced them to cast me, I paved the way, you know, like, and he wasn't just being like, you know, vain or whatever. He was just telling the truth. And we were like, wow, you're right. It does kind of track back almost exactly to him or his generation right around then.
Yes.
So I forgot what the question was exactly.
I'm just saying, isn't it interesting that here's little Johnny C, and he maybe decides he wants to be an actor. There had to be people in your life that were like, but you're not one of those.
Oh, my whole neighborhood was like, if you come from the working class on the south side of Chicago in the era that I was in, the main thing people said was, who the fuck do you think you are?
Yeah.
That's what I was raised being told, you know, get a job. What are you doing? You know, like, it was always people kind of always undervaluing you, you know, and you ask, like, do you think the journey is the same for someone that looked like Tom Cruise? Well, I know Leo DiCaprio really well. Like, I've known, I did a movie with him when he was 17 years old. And I think I've worked with him 3 times since then. And he's also one of the only people I've ever seen do an accurate, I think, impression of me. When he was 17, I was like, holy you little motherfucker. You realize he's been observing me this whole time. You know, Leo's really a character actor. That's the truth about him, I think. He actually has the constitution and the personality of a character actor. He's not someone who coasts by in his looks. But what I will say this about him, he didn't have any of that self-doubt stuff, or at least he didn't show it, that I had. Mm. He didn't come from a place where they were like, who the fuck do you think you are? He came from a place where they were like, whatever you want to do, you can do it. We believe in you. Mm. You keep going, keep going. Yes, dream big, dream big. And I was just like, what a gift to give a kid from the very beginning that.
Yeah.
You know, people could say something critical. Oh, he's just this golden boy and he doesn't know what it's like. But that's not true. He grew up with, like, not much money. And, you know, he had this whole thing when he was younger, when I started working with him when he was 17, of this whole Tiger Beat thing of girls from him being on the TV show when he was younger swooning over him as this hunk, as this, you know, kind of flavor of the week, good looking boy. But he knew he had more in him than that, so he was embarrassed by that stuff, all that kind of attention or whatever. But I remember looking at him like, man, this is a guy, he's never been told, who the fuck are you? He's always been told, like, no, you can probably do it. You should try. You should keep trying.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, and I thought, like, that's how I'm going to raise my kids.
And he still did it. It kind of goes against the idea that the success actually comes from the frustration of people telling you you can't do it. And that's why John C. Reilly said, I'll show you, and he kept at it. Is there some truth to that?
I think there's some truth to being like a middle kid. Like, I'm fifth of six.
Yeah.
So like when you're in a crowd like that, in the middle of a crowd, you're like, hey, I'm over here. Like you learn ways to like, I don't know, have some self-esteem or whatever, but.
And did you want to stand out? I have to imagine fifth of six, you want some identity, some recognition.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose that, I guess that one may have been subconscious because I it wasn't like I was ever consciously thinking that, but.
I was the second child and I was like, streaks on the china, like trying to do two things. Well, I was trying to calm the house down and I was trying to be special.
I've seen that with the second sibling where they're like a politician, like, get to meet your hand. I want your vote. You know, like they're like running for office from the time they come out of the womb because there's this other competition. And yes. Like, I'm the new one, but won't you love me?
Yeah, well, can't I be the favorite?
But I think the truth is, if you really take a really empathetic view of the way people are and the way they look and what they have to offer as artists, you just never know what the dark night of the soul for Leo DiCaprio or Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt or you know, Marilyn Monroe or whatever, people that look a certain way, who you make certain assumptions about, you just don't know what it takes to do what they do.
Of course.
And in Leo's case, you know, there were a lot of guys of his generation that were really cute that were in those Tiger Beat magazines. And how many of them ended up doing what he did?
The curse of Tiger Beat, man. You don't want to be in Tiger Beat.
I'm just saying, like, you have to have more than just a pretty face if you're really going to contribute something, and he does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hear that as, we'll happily have you just be in Tiger Beat. Like, the business will gobble you up and spit out your bones just with Tiger Beat.
Yeah.
It's not like, now that you're in Tiger Beat, we have a relationship. We want to see what else you got.
No.
He had to work that much harder.
In fact, it's the other way. It's like, if you get held up in that way, people just can't wait to...
Yeah, of course.
Smite you.
That's right. They want to put you out like a cigarette.
I've always thought, like, I remember when I was coming up in the 80s and, you know, doing plays and stuff and thinking, like, you know, kind of secretly dreaming, could I be an actor? And there was this group of actors called the Brat Pack who I thought, well, that's it. I'll never get a shot because I don't look like Emilio Estevez or Charlie Sheen or Anthony Michael Hall, who was like more of a character. Actor, excuse me, back then. But I remember looking at those guys and thinking, like, well, that's it. Those are the people that got picked from my generation to be the actors of my generation. So there's no room for me.
It's a depravity mindset.
I'll never be in the Brat Pack.
Yeah.
I won't be invited. The membership's full. So
Somebody made up at a magazine. And you're like, that's it. The Brat Pack's been decided.
I was just talking to Ione Sky about this the other day, who's a friend of mine. And she's like, and look what happened, John. Look what happened. You believed in yourself and you outlasted a lot of that, you know? Like,
yeah. Well, that's kind of what I'm saying is, like, isn't it interesting that a career, I hope you feel this way about your career. It's an enviable career. It's a magical, wonderful, diverse, interesting thing. And like going back to the South Side of Chicago, who are you? Get a job. And also even people like my mother, who in the 80s would have been like, that's no Leo. She's reading Teen Beat. And here you are outlasting and bringing something earnest and real that people relate to on the stage. Meaning it's not just, show business isn't just getting discovered at the Roosevelt Hotel, swimming with your shirt off, and some producer goes, that kid's a star. You know, it's not just that.
Yeah, well, there is a certain thing about movies where sexual charisma is one of the key things that sell movies. It's love stories, and that just is a fact of storytelling. You know, Romeo and Juliet. It's like there's guys who play Friar Tuck, and there's guys that play Romeo. Like, that's just the way it is, you know. But I think, actually, I'm kind of an anomaly. And I don't really credit my staying power with the audience saying, oh, no, we want to elevate that kind of person. We want someone who looks like that. I don't think how it happened for me. How it happened for me, I think, was continually believing in myself and thinking I could bring something and challenging myself. And then key relationships with directors.
Yeah.
People who, like Paul Anderson or Terrence Malick or Martin Scorsese, who are like, no, it's got to be that kid.
Yeah.
It's got to be that guy. Yeah, but he doesn't mean anything better than that. He doesn't look, I don't care. It's going to be that guy because something about him is honest and sincere and seems right, seems real.
Yeah.
I want it to be real. Like even Rob Marshall in that musical Chicago, he was like, I don't want this character to be a joke. I want it to seem real, that you really love Roxy Hart. And that's why I picked you, John, because you could sing, you could do these things that most musical theater people can do, but because I believed you.
Yeah.
And I always think about, like David Byrne said, you know, people don't really believe a singer that is too perfect and beautiful. I use my flaws to my advantage. And I think that's true. I think that's really why I've had staying power, is because of my flaws. You know, it makes me more relatable in a way.
This episode is brought to us by our friends at Vita Coco. I love Vita Coco when I'm feeling sluggish or dehydrated, or I just want to give myself a natural sweet treat without loading myself with added sugars and chemicals found in way too many beverages. I reach and have always reached for a Vita Coco. It's real. It's natural, it's from the earth, but it still tastes like a treat. Vita Coco is the number one coconut water brand in the United States. Get some balance in your life with healthy beverages that are actually fun, and Vita Coco comes in wonderful flavors, not just coconut, but pineapple and peach and mango, which I can tell you are incredible. Coconut water has nutrients to supercharge you and make you feel good, helps amazing with recovery, post-workout, post-dance party, and after my workout, Vita Coco replenishes me, keeps me performing at my best, shining strong for the rest of the day. It's also a wonderful mixer. You can throw it in with some tequila, agave, and a squeeze of lime, and you have an amazing cocktail that has electrolytes and nutrients in there, which means a better feeling morning after. It's also wonderful for mocktails, and because of the electrolytes, coconut water can help bring you back to life after a night of partying as well. So take 25% off and get Vita Coco shipped to your door, which is how I get it shipped to me, by using code WEIRD20 at VitaCoco.com. Or if you prefer to shop in-store, find Vita Coco at most big-name grocery stores in your city, as well as superstores like Walmart, drugstores like CVS, your local convenience stores and bodegas. That's VitaCoco.com. Get 20% off with code WEIRD20 at checkout. We're also brought to us by our friends at Ritual. As you guys know, my pre, post, and probiotic and my multivitamin for men for years has been from our friends at Ritual. If supporting foundational health was a sport, trust me, guys, you would want Ritual on your team. They made Essential for Men, a multivitamin that is based solely on science and designed to help fill common nutrient gaps in your diet with 10 key nutrients. According to the CDC, fewer men than women meet the minimum daily intake requirement for fruits and vegetables, and men are more likely to overvalue exercise and undervalue nutrition. So enter Ritual. They are here with a multivitamin scientifically developed for men to help fill those gaps in their diets. I've been taking it for years. Two pills in the morning, actually three, because I take the multi and I take the Symbiotic Plus probiotic. Every morning, it's got a minty essence, and you don't just pee it out like predator blood, because it has a delayed release effect, so it breaks down in your lower intestine where these vitamins can actually be absorbed. 10 key nutrients in those delayed release capsules per day, designed to dissolve later in the small intestine, which is great for fasting, gentle on an empty stomach, and a minty essence in every bottle that makes taking your multis actually enjoyable. So Essential for Men is a quality multivitamin from a company you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/weird. Start Ritual or add Essential for Men to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/weird for 25% off.
I would add to that, I was researching you. I didn't really have to because I'm such a fan, but I was, you know, giving it a look over. And I was like, oh yeah, the Sisters Brothers. And I loved that movie. But I had that moment of like, and this is actually a compliment, it wasn't that I forgot that you were in it, it's that I thought that was the Sisters Brothers. I forgot Joaquin was in it too. Oh, I didn't go, that's a Joaquin John C. Reilly movie. I was like, no, there were these two cowboys. Like, well, I really
when I was
that
younger,
way.
That was the litmus test, really, was when my own brothers or sisters would say, I forgot it was you.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh.
No, that's exactly what happened. And I think that's part of what's going on. And I also agree with you. I don't think people are going like, let's give this kid a shot. Like, yeah. as a ruse.
Yeah.
I think they're just enjoying it.
You know, the world in general is kind of a popularity contest. And
yeah.
You just have to find your way in anyway somehow if you feel like it's all you really can do. And that's really what, you know, I thought about other things, that being a priest or being a lawyer or you know, I thought about these other things, but then eventually I just came to this conclusion, like, well, if I'm an actor, I can do all of that stuff. I could play a lawyer one day.
Yeah.
I could play a priest one day.
Yes.
And I get to do the most exciting and interesting parts of that occupation. And then when it gets boring, move on.
Yeah. Everyone who listens to this show knows I'm going to say this, but I remember being a kid and I was obsessed with movies and I wanted to make movies. I wanted to act. I wanted to be a comedian. All that stuff was early on. And I would remember being like, I can't wait till I'm 30. Because then people would believe it if I wore a police officer's uniform and said, I'm a cop. But for a long time, I didn't have enough.
Have you ever interacted with cops these days? There's some pretty young ones.
Is that
like,
yeah.
Wow, that guy's in charge? Like, because a lot of cops and soldiers, different people come up to me and are like, thank you for, I love Step Brothers or whatever. And you're like,
yeah.
Man, you are very young.
Yes. You know? Ever get out of a ticket? I know it's kind of a dumb question, but I have to imagine.
I'm Irish and I come from the south side of Chicago. So in Chicago, I mean, better for better or worse, I suppose mostly for worse, if they looked at my license and saw I had an Irish last name and I was from Marquette Park, they were like, get the fuck out of
here. Oh, no.
What are you doing?
That is...
It's a red light. I would just only get out of tickets, you know?
But not because of Step Brothers.
Oh, no. Oh.
Now.
No. I'm a very good driver, so
You don't get
pulled
over.
Don't really get much interaction with the police, knock on wood. But I'm talking about when I was younger, you know.
Like, yeah. It's interesting when I think of you, for what it's worth, I was actually going to ask you, a guy like me comes up to you, and I go, I love you. What's your guess? If I go, John, I love, I'm such a huge fan. Do you have a guess on what a guy like me?
What movie you might have seen? Yeah. Yeah, it's like a game I play in airports.
Yeah.
It's hard because I kind of know you a little bit now, but I would probably say Step Brothers. I mean, that's usually the go-to.
Yeah.
Especially anyone who's in comedy or whatever. Like,
we watch Step Brothers once a year. We absolutely love it. It's like a weird... Awesome. It's a
absolute... I put a lot of myself into that movie. A lot of my personal stories are in that movie.
Like what?
Oh, like one of my brothers played the drums and was really possessive of his drum kit.
No way.
Getting jumped by a bunch of kids in a playground.
The dog shit?
Yeah, the dog shit was McKay's.
The white dog shit?
Yeah. But almost all the stories in that movie were stories from one of the three of us from our childhood, you know?
Wow.
We hashed it all out together.
I just think about the opening shot of the tortilla chips with just shredded cheese in the microwave. I was like, that's what it felt like. 18 years of my life felt like just like, that's nachos.
I remember I didn't have nachos. That was too exotic for the South Side. But I would sit in my underwear and watch Green Acres and eat a whole lemon meringue pie from the grocery store. You're like one of those boxed lemon meringue pies. That was just normal. The whole pie. I love lemon meringue pie.
Because it wasn't sliced, so that's one pie. That's a pie. That's a serving.
That and French onion dip.
French onion dip
popular
is big.
Around the South Side.
It reminds me of talking about eating when you're younger. Judd Apatow, who we both know, would say like he used to get off stage at a comedy club and have a double fettuccine Alfredo. That was like his go-to.
A double.
Bring me
Make
a double.
Make it a double. What does that mean? Like twice as much sauce? Or
No, two orders in one bowl. That's you with a pie. I bet calorically pretty similar.
Make it a double.
Wow. But he says it in the same way. Like we didn't know what we had, the superpower of
youth. Yeah, when I was a teen, I was super skinny for most of my, you know, I didn't really start to pack on any weight that stayed on until right around I did the perfect storm. I like just deliberately tried to gain weight, and it was a little hard to get off.
Oh, really?
But before that, I was mostly skinny and whatever. And I remember coming home on the bus from the boys' Catholic high school where I went, and at the transfer spot where I would go from one street to another, there was a McDonald's, and I would stop and eat two Big Macs, large fries, and a Coke, then get on the bus. And only 30 minutes later, my mom would have dinner ready when I got home. And an hour later, I would have like pot roast and mashed potatoes. And like, it's incredible the amount of food I could put away.
I feel the same way. It was a golden time. You mentioned Paul Thomas Anderson, which, by the way, for me, it would be a coin toss. I'd either say I love Step Brothers or I'd say I love Magnolia. And talking about being a priest, the image of that character praying, how he intercut that with your personal ad,
mm-hmm.
the audio of the, and there's just something so vulnerable about it. Like, you really like this guy, and it has so, who else, if I can butter your bread, who else could have done that? It's really tricky. You know, you and Phil Hoffman kind of had that in common. Like, Phil Hoffman, maybe it would have been different for sure, mm-hmm. but there's like a tender, like when you lose your gun in that movie,
mm-hmm.
I can't handle it. Like, I'm dying for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I could go into a long story about Magnolia.
I would love it.
How we came out with
that. I've seen it 1,000 times.
But when we were trying to get Boogie Nights made, and I was like ride or die with Paul at that point for many years, actually, where I was like I was his Reed Rothschild.
Yeah.
And so I was like, just every day, I was just with him every day. We just go, what are we going to do today? You know, like, and we were getting, was getting really frustrated because there was this taboo about porn, which is hard to even imagine now.
Oh, yeah.
But when Boogie Nights, when we're trying to put that together, it was like, what? You know, regular actors did not do anything about porn. And like, managers and agents were really dead set against it.
Yeah. It's pre-internet. We had the internet, but it was pre-fast internet. So if you liked porn, you were still like putting in your time.
I don't even know if there was internet at that point.
It might have been dial-up, but that it was still a niche market.
But we were struggling trying to get that movie made. And at the same time, Cops came out around the same time. And I had grown a goatee. And Paul was just teasing me mercilessly about the goatee. He's like, what are you, some kind of fucking hipster?
Shave
that
you?
Thing off.
Yeah.
I was like, no, it looks cool. I like it. You know, like, go for it. And then one day, I finally, like, just got, I was like, he's right. I should shave this stupid thing off. And I'm like, I'll shave off the bottom first. And I shaved it off. Then I had this perfect cop mustache. And I was like, oh, my God. I called up Paul. And you're not going to believe it. I got the most amazing cop mustache now. And he's like, we have to do Cops. We have to do our version of Cops. Because at that point, Cops had just come out. And it was one of the first reality anything things on TV. And he and I were obsessed with it. We'd call each other and be on the phone watching the episodes together. Like, oh, my God.
Like when Harry met Sally.
Yeah, we just thought it was so funny. Sir. You know, like, crazy things that they used to say.
There was a snake in the apartment. There's always a snake.
He's like, he saw the mustache. He's like, we have to do our own version of Cops. I'm going to get you a uniform. We got, some costume person got us a LAPD uniform, and I got these Oakley Blade sunglasses, and we would drive around in Paul's car, which was like an old Oldsmobile, but from the inside. That's the thing about cop cars. They only look like cop cars on the outside. So
yeah.
When you're inside it, he was videotaping me driving around. And a lot of the monologues that end up in Magnolia are from those videotapes.
No way.
Which we were just doing to entertain ourselves. So we do, like, we drive around, and then we would call, like, Phil Hoffman on the cell phone and be like, Phil, someone called the cops because your music was too loud. We'll be there in 10 minutes. He's like, whoa, just be ready. Hang up. And then on the way over to Phil's house, I mean, well, apparently this individual wants to listen to their music real loud. And, you know, like talking to myself or whatever. And we get there, and then we'd start improvising. And then Paul would film us improvising our way through like a police call at this house.
Wow.
And with the funniest part of them was always like when they would chase people and have to climb fences and clang, 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 clang. You hear their gun and all their equipment clang. We just, for some reason, thought that was so funny. And so we did
Where
a bunch
are these
of
tapes?
Those.
Where are they?
Oh, I think they might be on like some DVD of that movie. Or anyway, Paul has them all. But we did one with Jennifer Jason Leigh and like all these different people. And then when we made Boogie Nights, that finally came together. And then after that, Paul went back and he's like, what should I do now? He's like, oh, those tapes that we made of Cops, I'm going to go through those. And so he went through and like kind of created the character of Jim Curring from those tapes.
Mm.
So that whole monologue is always bad news. People never call you when their baby's born. They only call you when something bad happens, you know.
Yeah.
And it weighs on you, you know. Like all that stuff that I
and
say
then it
in the movie.
To reveal you're alone.
I'm talking to myself.
It's
but
so cool.
That was so he.
It's from that.
Yeah, and
it's from pure creativity, pure fun.
Yeah, just so there's
kids running
but
around.
The one thing I wouldn't do is carry an actual gun, because I knew, well, it's a felony to impersonate a cop. And if we get caught, even though we're not doing this for any reason but fun, if for some reason someone thought, you know, and at one point where there was like an altercation at Eda Pita, and I was sitting there in this uniform, like we just stopped for lunch, and the people are going, arrest him, arrest him. And I was like, I'm wearing a costume. It's not.
That is so funny. I wonder if a cop's ever done that. I'm going to a costume party, like something really dangerous. This is L.A. I'm an actor. And just run away.
But just to tell you where the lost gun bit comes from in that movie, there was at one point I was this long extended improv with Phil Hoffman and I, where I finally got him in the car and I was going to arrest him. And at one point he's like, I'm having a heart attack. And I was like, oh my God. And pull him out of the car and I set him on the ground. I'm like, what do I do? And all of a sudden he hops up and runs away. Ha ha ha, fuck you, cop. Ah. And he's like, and I go to reach for, this is when you would reach for your gun if you're a cop. And I go to reach it, but I don't have one. But we're in the middle of an improv and I go, I lost my gun. This is the worst thing that could happen to a cop. You lose. That's the one thing I'm supposed to keep track of. And I just started going on and on about this gun, how upset he was. And Phil's in the background, fuck you, how laughing at me. And it's this total humiliating moment that I can't chase him. I don't have a gun. And Paul took that. He took all this stuff that happened in those tapes that we were doing just to make each other laugh and deepened them and added this romantic thing with Melora Walters' character. And the whole thing of the gun, losing the gun, is this personal crisis that the guy has.
Yeah.
And made it super sad and real. You know?
Wow.
But it all came from just goofing around on videotapes before we even knew Magnolia was in the future. You know? Like,
yeah. Something pure, though. Isn't it fun that I feel like we're trying to trick ourselves back into those pixie times, like when we were kids and doing something for its own sake.
Yeah, well, that's what Paul and I were definitely doing that. And he was smart enough to know, you know, the genius of Paul was he knew I should go back to those videotapes because there were true things that emerged that were real and were emotional. And that is a character.
Yeah, they emerged organically too.
Yeah.
The LA cliche.
Like the name Jim Curring, I just made it up off the top of my head when we were driving around. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, anyway.
So if there's a Jim.
Took it and turned it into this beautiful thing that was very personal for him too. I think a lot of issues in his own life at the time he was exploring in that movie.
It's so beautiful. It's such a special movie to me.
Thanks.
Yeah, and you're wonderful in it. My favorite Magnolia thing that I read was that when Paul sat down to write it, he said to himself, I'm going to write a great movie, which just seems so meaningful to me. You know, it's like, I'm not going to write a movie. I'm not going to see what it's like. He's like, I'm going to write a fucking great movie.
There's a scene in that movie where, I mean, like I said, I was like really ride or die with Paul in those days. You know, we see each other less now because we have families, et cetera. And he's made a bajillion movies since these movies we're talking about. But at one point we had done Boogie Nights, and before he started writing Magnolia, we were both obsessed with this early film from the 1920s called Sunrise, and it's a romance. And it's all about this guy falling in love with this woman. It's this kind of tragic love story. And I was like, oh, man, that's the kind of... I want to do a romantic part like that. I want to do a movie like Sunrise. And I said to Paul, dude, write me a Sunrise. Write me a Sunrise. Thinking he knew exactly what I was talking about, that movie we'd already been talking about, right? But he didn't hear it as that. And in the movie, after the whole rain of frogs and everything, when there's this whole monologue where I'm in the car, it's kind of like, in a weird way, like an emotional catharsis in the movie where I say, you know, sometimes people need to be forgiven and sometimes they need to go to jail. And that's a tough call for me to make. And I'm in that car after I've dealt with Bill Macy's character and the rain of frogs has happened and the sun is rising. And that's what he wrote.
Because you said, write
me a sunrise. That's what he wrote. A sunrise in Magnolia, that sunrise scene as that after all the mess of that night.
Just a beautiful mistake.
Yeah, that's kind of brilliant.
A beautiful misunderstanding is what I mean.
Yeah.
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 Oh, I love that so much. Can you confirm, and you can just say pass, but can you confirm a Boogie Nights story that I heard, which is that Burt Reynolds was going to do a Scottish accent.
Not Scottish, no, Irish.
Irish.
Well, you know, you shouldn't speak ill of the dead. And Burt, really, I do have a lot of respect for Burt. And he was an important person to me personally as an actor, you know? Sure. And people forget this now, but Burt saw himself, and in the 1950s, the rest of the world saw him this way too, as a contemporary of Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
So he became Hooper and all this other crazy, he was good at comedy, Burt. So he became kind of more than Marlon Brando in a way as his career went on. But I think it's important to remember that about him. So
even though
I'm going to tell a silly story about him as an older man trying to understand what these weird people, Paul and me and, you know, all of us making Boogie Nights, how we were thinking. It was a generational gap there.
Yeah, sure.
So,
well, that's, I love
and
that. Yeah.
Burt had various things that made him feel insecure, I think. True parts of his personality and who he was that he didn't share with the world that were very private and I think made him very insecure in some ways.
Mm.
So I'll just preface this story with that, but he comes in one day, and we're going to shoot this scene in all the disco stuff. We shot a scene in the van on the way to Vegas. Everything was kind of out of order, but we shot that van where we pitch him our names. I'm going to be Brock Landers. He's going to be Chess Rockwell. We shot that scene, but Burt had a cigar the whole time, and he kept putting his hand up by his mouth. I thought it was because he had dentures, which he did, and he was like adjusting his dentures, and he was embarrassed about that.
Yeah.
He's like covering his mouth a lot. And I was like, oh, that's weird. But then the next day, we're shooting in the discotheque, and Paul comes up to me and says, you got to help me. You got to help me. Because I was kind of like Burt's little buddy on the movie. Like, he just, whatever. Older people often kind of take a shine to me for some reason.
Mm.
Like, a lot of my girlfriends growing up, their moms liked me more than but so I was like Burt's little buddy, and I was like crisis management for Burt, who was, he had a lot going on in his life. He had a lot of pain from injuries, taking pills and whatever. He's struggling in certain ways, like older people do, I now know.
Mm.
But Paul comes to me and he's like, you got to help me. You got to help me with Burt. And I was like, what? What happened? He's like, he just told me he wants to do the character with an Irish accent. And I was like, what? How did that conversation happen? He goes, he came to me this morning and he said, you know, I was sitting with my lady last night and I couldn't memorize these lines and I couldn't understand why I was not able to memorize these lines. And my lady said, well, who wrote it? You know, like he said, this kid, Paul Anderson. He's like, well, what's his ethnic background? And I think he's Irish, which that's not entirely true of Paul. He's part Irish, but
yeah,
I think he's Irish. And then my lady says, well, why don't you do it with an Irish accent? And he's like, so I cracked your code. I cracked your code. Those are the rhythms you write in. It's Irish. And Paul's just like, he doesn't know what to say. And he's like, you have to talk to him. You have to talk to him and talk him out of this. And I was like, Paul, I can't, he's going to flip out if I try, like, I don't want to say that. I don't know what to say. Like, and what about the scene we shot yesterday? He wasn't doing an Irish accent in that. He's like, no. He said, I got you covered on that. I was covering up my mouth most of the time so we can just loop those lines in. Because I think he already had the idea, but he hadn't presented it yet.
That's why he was covering his mouth.
He's covering his mouth up with a cigar so that he could dub his lines with an Irish accent later. And then all of a sudden, and I was just like, I don't know what to say, but you better tell Mark, you know, because they're supposed to shoot this scene, their scene where they meet in the dishwashing area of the club later that day. And Paul just freezes. He just, for some reason, he can't do it. We're all kind of afraid of Burt, you know, because he had this, he was older than everyone on the movie almost, you know, like, it was just like this, I don't know.
He's got gravitas.
Yeah. And he was like, yeah. So Paul does not tell Burt, and he does not tell Mark, and he thinks like, well, he'll just forget about it, you know? He'll just stop doing it, maybe. You know, he just goes into denial mode.
Oh, my God.
And they go to shoot the scene, and it's, Mark has not done a lot of work on film at this point. He's only one movie called Fear before this.
Yeah.
And maybe that's it. He doesn't have a lot of experience on the set himself, and Burt is like, ah, Eddie Adams from Torrance. And Mark's like, fucking Bert, and just laughs. And Bert's like, not happy that he laughed at it. And he's like, ah, fucking Bert. And then, and Paul's like, he doesn't know what to say. And they're like, just do it again. Let's do it again. And they go, you know, Eddie Adams, I think there's gold in those pants or whatever. And Mark's like, now Mark's like, you're fucking with me. And Mark is a pretty street dude at that point, you know, like, and he was like, are you trying to fuck with me? You know, and he starts getting this serious look in his face, like,
like he's pranking him.
Yeah, you don't fucking prank me. Like, we're doing a scene now or whatever. And then Paul's like, oh, shit. And that was a two shot. And he's like, cool, we got that. It's awesome. We got it. We're going to be playing the coverage anyway. And he just skips past the two shot and he films Mark's part. And then he films Bert's part when Bert keeps doing this Irish accent through it. And it's not a great Irish accent. It's slipping all over the place, and it's not consistent. And it just seems like really out of left field. They finished that scene. And then what eventually happened was Paul just figured out if I just do enough takes, he sort of stops doing it. And then Bert just kind of forgot about it.
That's what happened?
Yes, eventually. There were many days until the next scene, and I think Bert just maybe intuited, like, he doesn't like it, so I'll just sort of... But Paul just knew, like, if I do enough takes, he just gets tired out, and he just gets grumpy, and he just starts doing it just kind of basic, which is what he wanted him to do, you know?
So he exhausted him.
But there's there's a two-shot that has to be redone, because it's not, you know, whatever... And so Bert was really proud of himself as a director too. And so Paul went to him and was like, Bert, you're not going to believe it. The lab screwed up. Can you believe it? As a director, you know, what a disaster that is. Remember that scene we did at the dishwashing? There's a scratch right through the negative. I don't know what they did, but we got to redo that two shot. And he's like, no problem. I got you, kid. I understand. You know, like.
So he kind of flattered that director ego.
And then they just went back to it. And by then he had kind of forgotten about the Irish accent.
I can't believe it. Thank you so much for telling that.
It's a long story.
That story's been reduced to the way I heard it. Burt Reynolds, no one wanted to tell him. Burt Reynolds told Mark, I'm going to do an Irish accent. Mark said, that's hilarious. You should do that. Like laughing. And then he didn't do it. So it's been reduced.
It was on camera when he was
It's
like,
on camera.
Laughing at him. Yeah. I mean, I wonder if Paul has the footage, but anyway.
I mean, I sure hope so. There's another moment. I love Dr. Steve Brule very, very much.
And I'll tell him you said so.
I also have a message for Wreck-It Ralph. Like, we just start writing little letters to your characters. But Steve Brule is amazing. It's one of the things that makes me laugh harder than anything. And there was one Steve Brule question. I'd love to just talk about Steve Brule if you feel like it, but...
I was the executive producer on that show, and I've never spoken for Steve because he's his own person. But I'll try my best to help you with
this. You don't go on the record about Dr. Steve
Brule? I know it's annoying, but... That's how I feel about it. And people who love Steve appreciate that I'm this way about him.
That you don't talk about
him. He's his own person, yeah.
So you can speculate
on Steve. I was there. I was the executive producer with Tim and Eric. I helped create the show, but...
And there you were.
Yeah.
Well, then when you were there with Dr. Steve Brule in the episode about prison... And there's a guy that Dr. Steve Brule is sort of provoking, a real prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Tim and Eric style, it kind of jumps to later in the interview. And the guy is ready to murder Dr. Steve Brule. But you don't really see what happened. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think, yeah. I actually don't remember the part where he's going to murder me or murder Steve.
It's quite frightening.
Well, yeah, that's the thing about that. The brilliant thing about that show is, like, it's a hell world that Steve lives in. Nothing ever is nice for him. And the joke, what I love about that character is, like, the joke is always on him, you know? Like, it's always, he's always the dumbest one in the room.
Yeah.
But.
We say sweet berry wine a lot. Do you get sweet berry wine a lot?
Yeah, that's a pretty popular clip from that show. In fact, Sweetberry Wine exists. Eric Wareham started a wine company called Las Haras, and they sell Sweetberry Wine. And it's very good. And it has my face on the label, or it has Steve's face on the label.
No way. I almost want to show you the clip, but it's okay. If you don't remember what happened, it's all right. I really was worried for your safety. And if you don't remember, for Dr. Steve Rule's safety, but if you don't remember...
You know, a lot of times what you see on TV are just pretend, Pete.
If that guy's an actor, he's fantastic.
He is an actor who actually...
Guy in prison?
Yeah, he was a famous skateboarder who actually did go to prison for a violent crime and then got out and was trying to get into acting. So he had a life as a scary person once upon a time, but he was trying to be nicer.
You are exposing something that I get fooled by show business all the time.
Me too.
When people tell me that the Mad Men offices were a set, I'm like, hmm? Like, I just don't.
I've had this happen so many times where I'm going, I don't do as many meetings for parts anymore. People just kind of send me stuff. But for years, when I would go for auditions or whatever, there'd be other actors coming out of the elevator or whatever, like, hey, man, how's it going? Thinking you know the person. And then you get this blank look like, no, dude, I'm just an actor that you remember. Like, yes. Oh, like,
right.
Even someone like in the business who is an actor, like, yep. It's still, you fall prey to the illusion.
I've done it. You know, back when I was auditioning for commercials more, I would see somebody that was in a huge campaign. Those guys get it the worst because you're seeing them. Back when we're watching commercials, you might see them 12 times in an hour. Yeah. Some AT&T guy, and then you see him, and you're like, "What's up, man? I think we went to high school together." Which is more
back when we used to watch commercials.
Isn't that crazy?
Ad people over the world right now going, "Oh no, my angina!"
And then we cut to a commercial.
This episode is brought to us by our friends at Element, L-M-N-T. As you can see here on my hat, healthy hydration isn't just about drinking water. It's not 1951 anymore. We know so much more. It's about water plus electrolytes, which makes sense. You sweat out both water and sodium when you work out, when you exercise, and generally just when you move. And both need to be replaced to prevent muscle cramps, headaches, energy dips, and even mental fog. But most people only replace the water. Well, Element is here to help. It is a huge part of my wellness program and part of my morning routine that I sincerely look forward to, because not only is it delicious, but it floods your body with everything it needs for optimum hydration with zero sugar. Zero sugar, an amazing taste. It's flooding you with sodium, potassium, and magnesium for health, performance, and energy. I heard about that from Dr. Huberman, to drink salt water in the morning. Talk about Element. I got on board, and it makes me feel amazing and ready to go. And honestly, if I do exercise or walk the dog and come back and have an Element, it rushes my body and feels so good to replenish all of that stuff that I lost along the way. So it tastes amazing. I love watermelon salt is my favorite. They also make a mango chili, which is spicy, which I really, really love. And the chocolate salt and all of the chocolate flavors are amazing, and really amazing hot as well, which I sometimes have at night as a replenishing treat. Element came up with a fantastic offer for us. Just go to drinklmnt.com/weird and use promo code weird at checkout to get a free Element sample pack with any order when you order, which is great because you can try all these flavors I'm talking about. And if Element doesn't exceed your expectations, they have a no questions asked refund policy. You don't even have to send it back. So support your body, support this show. Go to drinklmnt.com/weird to get your free sample pack with any purchase. That's drinklmnt.com/weird and get that free sample pack and get it in your life. Support your body, support the show. We're also brought to us by our friends at Next Evo Naturals. You guys know I love CBD, and Next Evo has taken it up a serious notch. So many people want to try CBD, but they say the same things. They don't know how much to take, and they don't normally feel it because a lot of times you're not getting what is on the label. Well, spring is a perfect time to give it another go, and Next Evo is here to refresh your life and eliminate those things that don't work for you, like maybe that old CBD brand. With Next Evo natural CBD products, oil-based CBD can be one of the things that hit the bricks as you do your own personal spring cleaning. Oil-based CBD doesn't mix well with our water-based bodies, so you absorb as little as 6% of the CBD on the label. Next Evo Naturals developed a clinically tested water-soluble form of CBD, and their gummies and capsules are proven to work faster and absorb 4 times better than oil-based products, which means you can get the dose right and you feel it right away. I can attest to that. Their stress gummies are a game changer. It has ashwagandha, which is an adaptogen, and just the right dose of CBD. I take two of those, and 15 minutes later, I'm dissolving. I'm easing into what I have to do. It doesn't take me out of the game. It just helps me merge with those things I need to do. So NextEvo developed this clinically tested water-soluble form of CBD. 30 times better absorption in the first 10 minutes. Find new ways to use CBD with convenient options like gummies, capsules, dissolvable powders, which I sometimes add to my smoothies, and even creams that help speed your recovery after workouts. Give your life a refresh with the most effective and fast-acting CBD from NextEvo Naturals. For a limited time in April, get 60% off any order of $40 or more by using code WEIRD at NextEvo.com. That's 60% off any order of $40 or more only in April at NextEvo.com with promo code WEIRD. All right, everybody, back to it.
They're still finding
There's
ways.
Clown friend of mine, Bill O'Neill, who's very funny, is on all those Wendy's commercials right now. He's the skinny guy on all those Wendy's commercials.
I say I haven't seen a Wendy's commercial since 1989.
Somehow they made their way to me. My buddy Bill O'Neill is on them, and he's very funny.
Would you? I feel like you're not going to bristle at this, but if you do, bristle away, and we'll just move on. But I'd love, has someone ever given you some advice on acting that stuck with you? I've asked this question to a lot of people, and it's really interesting.
I'm not so bristly about it.
It's just share a gift. There are a lot of people that are going to listen to this that are interested.
This is a real simple one.
Yeah, hit me.
And this is actually really important. Although there's a back end to the story. Make sure you go to the bathroom before you act. Like if you have to pee, check in with yourself. Do I have to pee? And go pee. Even if maybe you don't feel like you have to pee, go pee
anyway.
Take
a road trip.
Well, when you're on camera, like then once you get to the set, it's not going to be convenient for you to go pee. And if you have to pee, for me anyway, there's an impatience to what you're doing then. Like some part of your brain is going like, hurry up and finish this so you can go pee.
Yeah.
But you want to be relaxed and in the moment and not have this kind of like bodily thing like knocking at your brain.
Yeah.
Although Jonah Hill told me, he's like, actually, dude, I purposely act when I have to pee.
To give it some urgency.
I don't know what it does for him, but it does something good for him. But I thought that was really good advice. Here's another one that I got from an old character actor that I did theater with named Robert Brewer in Chicago at Steppenwolf. He was like, John, if you ever have to fart on stage, make sure you fart during your line, not during the other guy's line, because the other guy might stop talking. And then, sure enough, I did this play Grapes of Wrath with Bob, and you'd hear him farting while he's talking. You'd hear him farting. Because he knew, like, as long as I'm talking loud, no one's hearing this. You know, or a cough and a fart at the same time or whatever. You don't want to be, like, letting it loose and then someone takes a pause, you know. And it's going to be real obvious.
Only
who's
you
farting.
Know. Is this fart done? Now I think, can buzz.
I think that's very practical advice for actors. And now there's another one that I remember. There's another one, which is... Oh, Michael Caine's one of Pick an Eye when you're looking at someone.
I saw that. That's on YouTube, Pick an Eye.
Yeah, Pick an Eye.
And also he says, don't blink. He does a scene twice and he's like, watch how much more compelling it is if I don't blink. And he doesn't blink and you're like, oh my God, it's true.
Yeah. Well, of course, you don't want everything to be like that, but that's true, yeah.
If you're trying to be impactful, I suppose. Pick an Eye,
blinking
less.
Can be a great way to...
Well, when I heard
else.
Him say that, I was like, you know, you watch Daniel Day-Lewis and There Will Be Blood. The man's blinking. He's blinking quite a bit. Joaquin is blinking a lot. In The Master, are you fucking nuts? That doesn't work for those characters. You know what I mean? Those are blinking boys.
Well, Brian Dennehy came to, God rest his soul. I think he passed away. If he didn't, my apologies. If he did, my apologies. He came to my school when I was in acting school in Chicago, and he was on stage and he was like, this Q&A, and all of us were like, oh, someone from the real, you know, Peter Falk came at one point, David Mamet came at one point. Mm. We had these amazing speakers that would come and talk to the students. And Brian Dennehy said, you know, someone said, well, what about, like, how do you deal with, like, your family, like, with your kids or whatever? Like, how do you have a career? And he's like, don't have kids. Don't get married. You know, I did, but my family knows the acting is more important than you. My career is more important than you. All my kids know my career is more important than you, because that's what an artist is. You have to be totally committed to your craft, and nothing else can be a priority. And I was like, holy shit, this is big news. Like, I was hoping at some point I would have a family or whatever. Like, and I was like, wow, he must know, though. He's Brian Dennehy. He must know. And for years, I kind of avoided, I used to think, like, getting married was like, I thought the two scariest things to me are prison and getting married. You know, like, you have to be free and you have to be committed to your art and blah, blah, blah. But it's total bullshit. That's totally wrong, what he said. Mm. And I feel bad for his family if that really was how he acted. Somehow I think he was kind of showboating for the Q&A and trying to make us realize that being an actor is a serious vocation and you have to commit yourself and you have to take yourself seriously. And I do think that that is true. But getting married and having a family actually made me become who I was meant to become. Yeah. It gave me confidence and focus. Mm. You know, like, once I had a relationship that was steady in my life, I've been married like over 31 years now. Like, once I had that, I could stop worrying about dating or whoever, if I was ever going to find somebody. Then that part of my life was kind of like settled and I could focus more on what I needed to focus on. The same thing with children. You think, like, I waited a long time to have kids. We were married for, I think, 6 or 7 years before we had kids. But the same thing. You think, like, oh, man, it's going to take away from me. It's going to whatever. But the truth is, anything I now know, anything that we do for love only builds us up, only makes us bigger and more fully realized versions of ourselves. So I wish Brian Dennehy could have known that in his life, because I think men of his generation, I think especially my father was part of his generation, they missed out on a lot.
Yeah.
They were at work all the time or at the tavern or whatever, and they thought, like, you know, the women handle the kids and our job is to work. Yeah. Not have relationships with our kids. Like,
right.
It makes me feel really sad, actually, when I think about all the things my dad missed. You know, as I moved through my children's lives, I thought, wow, my dad missed all of this. Hmm. My dad never once went to a school where I went. Hmm. And I directed plays at my kids' schools. Mm. You know, I was there, part of their classroom, knew their teachers, knew their classmates, knew what was going on, what they were interested in, everything. Mm. And it was just nothing but added richness to my life, you know? Like, so you have to make room and you have to take your art seriously and you have to really do the work and show up for yourself when you need to grow as an artist, but you don't have to sacrifice all that personal stuff to do it.
I really appreciate that you said that. And of course, I agree with you. We have a daughter, and getting married and having a kid isn't just helping my life. It is my life. And then it becomes almost paradoxically like you sort of take some focus off your work, but then it makes your work better. Instead of being like a lunatic kind of obsessing about it, there's a little bit more flow.
Well, you know this from being a comedian. You can't just hang around with comedians all the time.
Yeah, you have to have a life.
All you're doing is you're reflecting reflection of a reflection of a reflection.
Yeah.
So live your life so you have something to say about what life is.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
Yeah. Did you have any... I am so in awe of you, but when I mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis, I remember that you worked with Daniel Day-Lewis. How was that?
It was intense.
Yeah.
It was intense.
I saw a Scorsese interview where he said that Daniel would listen to Eminem in the morning, like to get into Bill the Butcher.
I never knew that, but whatever he was doing to psych himself up. I know that he was fully in character all day long. You would never see him in any kind of like by the snack table or anything.
He didn't get snacks.
Always in costume. And they only started making him wear a warm-up coat when he caught pneumonia on the set, because he would only wear his own his costume of his character, and eventually got really sick, and they were like, "You have to wear," and he was like kind of grumpy about it, but he was. I remember we each had sons at the time, and somehow I got invited to come to the house where he and his wife and their son were, and bring your kid, because, you know, here we are
this
in Rome.
During production?
Yeah.
Because it was like, didn't you shoot that over like years?
No. It was about 6 months in Rome.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Then maybe it was pre-production, because Martin Scorsese was talking about how long it took, and the sets were so elaborate.
It took him forever to get that movie made, for sure. But so I go to this weekend, and he's this loveliest guy. You know, Daniel's like, "Oh, hello. Can I have? Would you like a cup of tea?"
Yeah.
You know, almost like a
he's
whole,
Phantom Thread,
like a
Daniel.
Different personality. Yeah. Like, yeah. He's pretty mean in Phantom Thread.
That's true. but he's, you know, he's debonair and sweet at times.
But he's just gentle and the most lovely host. Like Irish people are, you know, he comes from Irish people. Like, come in, have a cup of tea. How are you? Sit down at the table with me and the kids and whatever. And so we do that one weekend, and I thought, that's it. I'm in with Daniel now. Like, we're friends. Our kids have played together. Like, so I see him on Monday, and he's in costume again. And I'm like, "Hey, Daniel, I just want to say thanks for the weekend." He goes, "Fuck off, Jack." Calls me my character's name and walks away. But he meant it. You know, I was like, oh my God. Okay. So that whatever happened on the weekend was not what's happening now. And Daniel has this, I don't know what it is. Like, he's obviously a fit guy, but I think I would stand a chance in a fist fight against him. Maybe. I mean, he studied boxing, so maybe not, but
yeah.
But just in terms of his, you know, there are scarier people physically.
I will say it depends. If the script says that Daniel wins, he'll win. if it's an improv, I think you win.
But there's something about him. There's this a current of violence, that this frequency that's underneath whatever he's doing, that makes him very scary.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, you don't want that demon to come out of the bottle, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever that undercurrent is, whatever that electricity be underneath is, you don't want to see it.
Yeah.
And he's genuinely intimidating in that way.
Yeah. You know? Talk about not being embarrassed, again, which is me and Ted Danson's thing. You know, like when you're playing...
I was embarrassed when I was younger. I remember thinking like, what am I supposed to do with my arms?
Talladega Night.
Oh, right, yeah.
Did that get into the movie? Will.
No, I think that's just something young actors think about.
Yeah.
But
yeah. But I mean, to be scary, I heard, what's his name? Gomez? It doesn't matter. I guess it doesn't matter. There was a guy who got a part in a movie by the casting director just said, "Give me a look that makes me think you're going to kill me." And he did it. Luis Gomez? No, that's a comedian. I know him as a voice in Grand Theft Auto. It doesn't matter. This is Danny Trejo? No, it wasn't Danny Trejo, but it is a Latino man, and he's wonderful, and he's in everything, and he kind of has a lisp. He didn't come over here like that. That was a pretty good impression, actually. Some of you are screaming at your radios.
Oh, I can't think of it.
I can't either. But anyway, he did it, and he got the part because he gave the look. And if I feel like you're a guy that if the casting director was like, "Give me a look that says you're going to kill me," you would do it. And I would just get red-faced and like embarrassed. And like, it would be like, that's impolite. Like, I don't want to scare you.
Well, you're a different person though.
Yeah.
I don't think you necessarily are an actor.
That's what I mean. You're like a true actor.
You primarily are a commenter on life. You know, that's what comedians are. It's a skill that I'm really, like, when I sat down here, like, the final frontier for me is doing stand-up comedy. Yeah. I really have a lot of respect, and just from a philosophy point of view, like, listening to you or Sarah Silverman or, you know, when you hear a great comedian reflect life back to you, like, there's something really deep about it, and it's not just like, how about peanuts on airplanes, you know? There's some deep stuff that you get into. Anyway,
so that's my skill. I agree.
Self-deprecation is a main thing of comedians. That's one of the main tools you have. Is like, well, I'm an idiot, but isn't this funny? You know, like,
and connection.
Actors, it's a different breed.
I agree. So look what's happening in that moment. If a casting director is like, give me a look that makes you think I'm going to kill me. What did I say? I was like, well, have these been here the whole time? It's like, they're my audience. And as a comedian, my paramount thing is that they know that I'm being real with them. Mm-hmm. I know that's silly, but I'm like, but you know, I don't want to kill you. You know, I want you to like me, to give me the part. Yeah. That's why parts I've gotten, I've either written for myself, or it helps that I'm kind of a sweaty comedian that's like, well, I hope they like me.
You want the advice. It's like you have to channel the fact that this person's making you do this, and you and their power dynamic. Some part of you wants to kill the casting director too, right?
So you find the part of you that does want to kill
And you expand that, you know? Like
zooming in.
But I think I'm the same way, actually. Like, I think performers in general are all very, very different, and we're all unique products of our past. Mm. So, you know, like we talked about Phil Hoffman. Phil, I really looked up to Phil so much as an actor, and he just had inherent skills and gravitas that to me, when I would compare myself to Phil, I would almost see myself like I'm a circus performer compared to Phil. Mm. Like I'm someone who I'm thinking about the audience all the time. You know, like I want them to know I'm being real with them. Even though I'm playing a character, I want them to know I'm being genuine. I'm being sincere. You know, so.
And Phil wasn't doing that?
You know, Phil, like, I don't know. He had this ability to kind of channel. Like you really believed who he was. It wasn't. I'm not being very eloquent here.
No, I know exactly what you mean. It was sort of a next level. When I think of him and Magnolia ordering the nudie mags, and he's doing this.
Or someone like De Niro, I'm a very different kind of actor than De Niro, you know, like, even though you could say, well, you both have the same job. You act on film, so there must be all these commonalities, but there aren't. There aren't commonality. He comes from his background, what he learned as a kid, the experience he had, whatever his natural abilities to create illusion and stuff. Mm. He has his own approach. That's one of the funny things about up and coming actors. Like, what is it, Meisner or the Method or Viola Spolin or improv or what is the best acting technique? And it's just absurd to even try to like put. You know, to put one over another, you know, just whatever works for you, whatever brings out of you what you need it to bring out, you know, like, because I always thought like method stuff, I always thought like, well, you know, think about your dead grandmother. Well, I have to remember my lines. Like, I have to think about this person, not my grandmother. If I start thinking about my grandmother, so I used to go to her house for tea, and better, you're like, I'm off thinking about some other bullshit. Like, some of those method techniques never really worked for me. I never really believed in them, you know?
Yeah. No, I completely get that.
So you have to find your own way to it. You have to find your own way towards honesty in your work and...
Did you learn anything from Phil? Meaning just specifics. Was he a big rehearser? Was he not a rehearser? Was he mingling around the set?
Theater too. So we had a lot of commonality in terms of our approach, actually, I think. We didn't really talk about craft so much or methods.
Yeah.
It was more just like, you know, we were competitive with each other, to be honest. You know, we were very similar in age, trying to get for the same parts, you know, like... We were competitive with each other. So in that way, we had a respectful competition, you know. Yeah. But it wasn't like we're sharing secrets or whatever.
Did you ever lose a part to him?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time, yeah. He was a force of nature. I was just in awe of Phil, you know. But there was one, I'll tell you this story that I told actually at the wake, at the funeral home for him, which is that we were doing True West, and there's this, I don't know if you remember the play, but there's this whole section where one crazy brother has stolen all of these toasters from all these houses in the neighborhood, and the house is a wreck, and there's toasters all over the house, and I had my back to Phil during one of these parts. You know, we switched roles, though, so we each had to do this, you know? And I think he's playing the screenwriter character, and I was like the desert rat character. he was playing Austin, I was playing Lee, and in this iteration of the thing. And during this one part, when we start using the toasters, there would be this huge laugh. It would be silence, and then this huge laugh. But I couldn't see what Phil was doing. And I was just like, wow, what is that laugh? You know, like, I'm too proud to turn around and see.
You want to, though.
Yeah, I wanted to do that. And after a while, after a few months of doing it, it was so consistent. Finally, I had some friends that had seen the play a number of times, and I was like, hey, can you do me a favor? The next time you see the play, you know that part when the toasters come? Can you tell me what Phil is doing? Because I'm mystified why he's getting this huge laugh, you know? And then sure enough, the friend comes, oh, so what he does is he puts the toast in the toaster, and then he presses it down, and he looks into the toaster, and he feels if the toaster's working, if it's hot or not, you know? Which is just really finely observed human behavior. It's what almost everyone does when you put toast in a toaster. If you think about it, you put it in, you click it, and then while you get a little impatient waiting to see if it's working, you put your hand over it. Is this actually on? You know?
Yeah.
It's this really identifiable human
real
behavior.
So he was killing with human behavior.
And I was like, thanks for telling me to my friend, like, next night I'm playing that part. And like, I put the thing, push the thing down, put my hand over it, crickets. No response at all from the audience.
Wow.
Because I was trying to do a gag, you know, I was trying to do what, I was taking almost like a circus performer's attitude about it. Oh, I know the trick now. You put the toast in, you put it in, then you get the laugh.
Right.
But I was missing some really important, genuine ingredient that Phil had, which was, he wasn't trying to be funny. He was trying to be exactly real and do behavior that was recognizable to him.
Wow.
When dealing with a toaster, you know.
Wow. Incredible.
Anyway, I told that story at his funeral at his wake, and it brought down the house.
So you finally got your laugh.
I guess.
Wow. Would you say being present is a big skill, like being in the moment?
That's it. That's everything. Being in the moment, the eternal moment. And really, I was throwing shade on various acting techniques and methods of teaching acting, but what really worked for me was Viola Spolin, Games for the Theater, which is the improv Bible kind of.
Yeah, I read that.
That's when I discovered really how to take acting seriously and what it was. It gave me things to do besides memorizing lines or putting on attitudes, you know. It gave me like real skills in it. I don't know, like that's what unlocked it for me. You know, that's how I got from musical theater to doing Sam Shepard, you know, was improv and what to do with your hands. Improv teaches you all that. It teaches you to be present right now. And that's a beautiful thing I think about coming up in Chicago. I don't know what it's like for actors in Chicago now, but when I was coming up in Chicago doing theater, you weren't going to get famous overnight in Chicago. You just weren't. If you were in New York or LA, chances are there could be an agent that came to see a play you're in, and you could be a star overnight in New York or Chicago, New York or LA, but not in Chicago at the time. Even though Malkovich got pretty famous, but that was when they took their plays to New York, when they did Balm and Gilead and True West in New York. That's when those actors really hit it. Yeah. But in Chicago, it was always like you were taught the only way to succeed is in combination with other people. If I really give you all of my focus and I find this moment with you and I'm with you right now for real in this moment, we may succeed together. Mm. You know, that's how you do it. If, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. Like that was the kind of ethos. Cause it wasn't like, give me my chance. I'm going to become famous tonight. Cause there might be an agent in the crowd. It was that was just never what was going to happen. You know?
Have you seen Mike Birbiglia's movie, Don't Think Twice?
No.
I think you would like it. It's a really great movie.
I like that. I've seen some of his stuff. Philosophy. I really like his take on life.
Yeah. He's wonderful. He's an incredible person. And that movie is awesome, but it's about, this won't spoil it, but it's like the improv team on the night that the SNL scout comes. And, you know, honestly, I related more to the guy that did Showboat. I was like, that's what I would have done. Like, he's working his way in but with his impressions.
I was taught early on, you might get 10% of something, but you throw away 90% of what's possible if you do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, in some ways, not to talk ill of the dead, but in some ways, Phil Hoffman grew up in New York. And Phil, when we would go on stage to do True West, Phil came up in New York, so it was like, I had to fight to stay in connection with him. Like, come on, Phil. It's you and me. It's you and me. And he was like, yeah, okay. I know that's true, but I'm going to get mine tonight. You know, this is how you survive in New York.
Yeah.
This competitive place, John.
Yeah.
I got to connect with the audience. They're my partner. And it was like a learning curve for both of us. I had to learn how to make the audience my partner too. And Phil had to learn how to be in the moment with only me. You know?
Yeah.
I think that's, I've noticed that in actors, people that came up in LA or New York, they tend to like, you get on stage and like, you're right, who am I going to, you know, like,
they cheat out.
Yeah, they kind of, they want to partner with the audience instead of partner with you. And, but for better or worse, and if you look at my career, I mean, I've done more duos than I've done single roles. Almost everything I've done has been in concert or
Sister Brothers,
Step Brothers, Wreck-It Ralph. Everything I've done, Stan and Ollie.
Cyrus.
Yeah, exactly. It's always been in partnership with someone else. That's how I understand acting, is to get into, lock into a reality with someone else and be in the moment with them.
Yeah.
And then you're in a shared objective reality.
Yeah.
As opposed to trying to like outdo someone or, I don't know. It's tough to partner with a camera. You know, it's better to partner with something real in front of you.
And you can do it real with the person. They can be your anchor to reality. Yeah, I agree. They told me you had till 3:30, but they were wrong about everything else.
No, I actually do have a doctor's appointment.
Oh, really?
Which is not negotiable.
Not negotiable.
In this town.
How do you book that? Who books that? I'm just kidding.
I book it.
You're the booker. Well, you've over delivered, and you're a delight, just as I hoped.
Well,
and I was thrilled that you would do this.
Just to circle back around, though,
Mr. Wonderful,
Mr. Romantic,
Mr. Wonderful, the shark on Shark
Tank. We're doing
Tank.
Mr. Romantic at Largo again on May 18th, and we're trying to grow the show. We're going to take it to other cities and stuff too.
Wonderful.
It's an emotional magic show.
Well, and you're a wonderful live performer, having seen you at Largo many times. And I'm sorry I haven't seen it yet, but I will. And I'm going to see it on May
18th.
You just said it, May 18th, at Largo. Yeah, Largo-LA.com for tickets.
And more after that, too.
All right. That's exciting, man. Well, thank you very much. We have the guest say, keep it crispy at the end.
Keep it crispy.
How is it different as Wreck-It Ralph? It's just a question.
Is
your voice
different?
Like you affect it?
It's more like an attitude. It's like, it's always trying to keep it crispy. He's always trying to deal with the size and breaking things. Oh, dope.
Oh, you get Modern Mammals too. That's your shampoo.
It's a lot of.
Oh. It's my favorite shampoo. You got great hair. You'll love
Modern Mammals.
It cleans your hair, but it doesn't make it dried out and shitty.
Great.
Yeah, if you like it, I'll have them send you more. It's really wonderful.
I don't do ads, Pete. Come on.
Take the Modern Mammals. Take it.
I'll take it when the camera's off. But not on camera, no.
Well, we appreciate it. Thanks for saying keep it crispy twice. And thank you. That's it. We're done.
My pleasure. And thank you. Thank you for sharing your love with the world.